Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
So from the very beginning, it's been a push for a type of industrial production because it's been created by men who were trying to extract as much wealth and power as possible from the majority. In terms of making the few rich and extracting from the many, it works. But in terms of efficiently using the natural world to produce what we need, it could not be more wasteful. It could not be more criminally toxic, polluting, and wasteful.
Criminally toxic and wasteful are terms that one would hope not to hear about the chief byproducts of our global economies. But we know it's compromised territory just by observing the stranglehold that global banks hold on governments and the world's irreplaceable environment. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money. I'm Walt McCree. When we talk about your money, we often talk big picture, using the notion that money is a relationship with a common engine of interaction and productivity. We all rely and support that engine at some level, even if we don't like what the engine produces and requires of us. Today's guest, whose comments opened our program, is Helena Norberg Hodge, the founder of Local Futures, a nonprofit dedicated to revitalizing local economies worldwide, and also the producer of the award-winning documentary, The Economics of Happiness. She brings together the disconnect that we experience when we try to find social and economic happiness while being immersed in a system of exploitation and social disintegration created by lives that are disconnected from nature and our neighbors. If one were to look at the essentials of personal and societal happiness, one could probably quite easily come to the conclusion that the best things in life, the ones that really make you happy, are free. So, an economics of happiness would probably have to go down that path, right? And so it does. Our current global economy, dominated by financial gain and growth, holds very little sustainable long-term benefit for the environmental quality of life in all its forms, or the prospects that we can reintegrate interpersonal dependencies, which are the social fabric of personal exchange, and get them back into a place of core functioning within our local economies. We'll be hearing from Helena a bit later in the program. And consistent with her theme, we can see how the power of global finance and Wall Street undermines even our best efforts at trying to control the abusive practices of the big banks. This past week, for example, Congress removed an important citizen protection against these abuses, which allows bank executives to protect their bad practices from class action lawsuits. We'll hear from noted economist and white-collar crime expert Bill Black about why this is another brick in the wall of big bank immunity from prosecution. As Bill Black said earlier on this program, there aren't anywhere near enough regulators to actually keep a lid on the corruption that is endemic to the industry, that actually creates our money as a debt to itself. And there's another important impact of the big bank control regime. It too dwells in the area of bank regulation. You'll recall the Dodd-Frank effort to control bank practices. Well, Wall Street also rigged that effort in a clever way that has also undermined one of our key local social and economic assets, community banks. Ellen and I talked a bit about her latest article on this.
I just wrote about overregulation killing the community banks. Somehow, the big banks managed to get these regulations to serve them. Like the Dodd-Frank Act, in theory, was to downsize the banks, to eliminate too big to fail. That's the way it was sold. It would eliminate too big to fail. Well, it did eliminate too big to fail by making sure that they couldn't fail, because it provided in very obscure language that took us a long time to figure out, that the big banks were authorized under the bill to actually bail in their creditors' money, which meant they could confiscate their creditors' money and turn it into capital for the bank, recapitalize themselves with their creditors' money. And the largest class of creditor of any bank is its depositors. So they managed to work that to their benefit. And the parts that weren't to their benefit, they managed to repeal. But who was really hurt by the Dodd-Frank Act and even more by the Patriot Act are the small banks. And it looks like, because of the regulations are so onerous, that the small banks have just been disappearing. There were, in 1995, there were actually 13,000 banks with assets under $100 million. And by 2014, it was down to 1,900. So it had shrunk, whatever, like by a factor of seven times. But most of that shrinkage was actually before 2010. So it was actually from the Patriot Act, which itself was highly suspicious. The regulation is killing the little banks, and that's why they're selling out to the big banks, because they get hit with 1,000 pages of regulations, and literally 1,000 pages. And so they have to hire special staff to figure out what to do with the regulations. And there is reason to believe, different people have said, that that was intentional, that it was supposed to kill the small banks and force them to merge with the sellout to the big banks, because only the big banks have enough staff to deal with the regulations. So what I was actually writing about is that the one state that doesn't have this problem is North Dakota, and the reason is because they take care of their small bankers and they actually help them with the regulations. And that's also true of the Sparkassen banks in Germany, that they have, there's only one Bank of North Dakota, but the Sparkassen banks, I forget, there's many branches
of them,
anyway, and I think they have 250,000 employees,
right?
15,600 branches, so there are a lot of Sparkassen banks, and what they do is they pool their resources and deal with the regulators collectively. So there are different ways you could get around the regulations if you have a public bank partnering with the private banks, which is what the Bank of North Dakota does. But you were making another point, I think, so go ahead.
This past week, is a number of interesting things have happened with our money, one of which I think is of note. We really need to take some note of it, and that's that Congress, by one vote, pulled away a primary protection for the consumer relative to the relationship with banks. Consumer Financial Protection Board, which is being disabled as the months go by with the new administration, just lost its primary protection for consumers against the bankers.
If you sign an agreement with your bank, they can require you to go to arbitration if you have an issue.
And people think the word arbitration sounds fair, right? Like there's going to be a fair negotiation. But the justices that are appointed, are hired, are basically corporate shills and typically rule to, in the 90s, 95, 97% of the time for the corporate interests. That's going to be the limit of our dealing with them. And Bill Black made a comment on a news program talking about how important that was. And I wanted you to hear that, and then so we can talk about it.
These regulations didn't come close, didn't have anything to do, nothing on this dimension of supposedly strangling the economy. The banks have been insanely profitable. Growth has been very substantial. The thing that has limited growth, that has limited bank profits, has been the fraud by the senior officers. So it's exactly the opposite of what they say. The rule was good for consumers, but the rule was also good for honest bankers and honest banks. This repeal bill was the highest priority of the absolute worst bankers in the United States of America.
If you have a class action, you can do discovery, and that's when you really find out what's really going on. Whereas if you just got a little $2,000 claim, it might be true that you'd get more money out of the arbitrator, you know, if you just go in with your little $2,000 claim.
But you'll never get to the big news.
But you're not going to get to who the real culprit is. You know, it's going to be more of the same.
And so the supreme leaders of the global banks will never be gotten. Or I won't say never.
Right, but. Right. They're, and that's the reason, as he was pointing out, that they're so desperate to get rid of that rule, because that's actually how they could be found out. All the more reason to say, do you want to trust these banks? You really have no recourse against them. Right. And we're talking about particularly the big banks. I mean, it might be true, as the Republicans said, that the little banks were hurt by this. But, I mean, they're hurt by all these onerous rules because they can't deal with them. And they weren't the culprits in the first place. It was the big banks that brought on the 2008 collapse. And the little banks are the ones that are having to suffer all this punishment. I saw that after 9/11... New Jersey was particularly hit hard with it. So they came after it because New Jersey was a state where a couple of the hijackers supposedly had banked. And so they went after the New Jersey banks particularly hard. So there were two little banks. One was fined $5 million and one was fined $8 million. Yeah. And it wasn't because they were money laundering. It was just because they hadn't put the rules that they were supposed to have. So they hadn't dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's.
Right.
So that has totally scared off all the other small banks because they just can't afford to take that risk. So they just don't get in, even get into areas that they used to get into. For example, in North Dakota, the rural lenders are they're just afraid to make, if they only have a handful of loans a year in a particular area, they can't afford the regulations for that.
Right.
So they just don't go there. So you just can't get a mortgage in certain places. So the Bank of North Dakota stepped in. Directed by the legislature to step in. And normally the Bank of North Dakota's statute says that they are not to compete with the local banks. But in this case, they are directly making mortgages, and the reason is they're not competing. The local banks aren't going there. So what happens is the local bank gets sort of a finder's fee. I mean, they're still partnering with the Bank of North Dakota, but the Bank of North Dakota technically touches the client first, and therefore they have to deal with the regulations, and then they can share the work with the smaller bank. So that's
clever.
One way that they've gotten around the rules.
And a beautiful example of how useful a public bank can be as a partner in that business.
Right.
And one of the things you pointed out in the article also was how much the psychology in the agency is that we want to consolidate the banks. It's easier to regulate, fewer number of banks. It'll take fewer people. So the dynamic trend toward consolidation, reducing the community level finance, also seems to be active.
Yeah, which is also relevant to our interviewee today, Helena Norbert Hodge, who is all about going local, so unconsolidating, basically deglobalizing and going small.
Yes, she's got an interesting contrast about the efficiencies of local economies and how it's a myth that scaled enterprises, like agriculture, for example, is actually more efficient in production of food, as just one example. She's got a lot of interesting stuff to say.
We should also mention, her talking of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, was the New York Times has actually apparently endorsed him, or at least in an opinion page has endorsed him. So it looks like he's definitely going to win the election, and he has made a state bank the basis of his platform.
Well, being from New Jersey, I can say that no, everybody has their hopes, but no one's taking things for granted. It'll be interesting because there's a lot of excitement around the state bank prospect. So we shall see what happens next. Well, good talking to you, Ellen. Let's do this again.
Okay.
Take care.
Our thanks to Aaron Maté and our friends at The Real News for that clip with Bill Black.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Helena Norberg Hodge, the founder of Local Futures, a nonprofit organization dedicated to revitalizing local communities and economies worldwide. Among a long list of noteworthy accomplishments, she is the producer and director of the award-winning documentary, The Economics of Happiness, which lays out her arguments against economic globalization and for localization. She is an inspiring motivational speaker and is now on one of many speaking tours promoting these ideas. It's so great to be speaking with you, Helena.
Really glad to be here.
We met at a conference in Portland, one of your Economics of Happiness conferences, and I really enjoyed hearing you speak there. You've been doing amazing work. So just for anyone who's not familiar with it, do you want to like tell us about how you got started and like particularly the Ladakh story?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'm a bit reluctant to talk about Ladakh because people end up so focused on that. But it was certainly the, you know, with Ladakh, which is Little Tibet or West Tibet, which forced me to see our economic system in a holistic way. And it happened because I was a linguist and I'd been invited out as part of a film team to this remote part of Tibet that belonged politically to India when it had just been thrown open to the outside world. It had been sealed off for political reasons in the modern era. And then in the earlier colonial era, when so many traditional cultures were, well, either decimated or certainly fundamentally transformed by slavery and so on, this part of the world had not been affected by colonialism. So when I arrived there in the mid-70s, I found a very different baseline in the sense of what does the world look like before the modern growth system, you know, and the banking system that you talk about, what was life really like? And it turns out that, you know, I found people who were healthier, stronger, and vastly better off than I would ever have imagined. From my extensive travels in the world, I had seen quite a lot of the world. I spoke at that point about 6-7 languages and, you know, thought I had understood pretty much what the world consists of. But here I found this other world that was just amazing. And more than anything, what just fascinated me was that these people seemed happier, more joyous than any people I'd ever encountered. So I had come out as part of a film team. I was going to be there for 6 weeks, but I became so fascinated and really fell in love with the people. So I stayed after the film was finished. And then, having learned to speak the language fluently, I had my eyes forced open to how the global consumer culture operates and how we have a system that simultaneously destroys people's genuine individual identity, their cultural identity, their racial identity, and at the same time artificially creates unemployment and scarcity of limited resources by essentially promoting a model whereby people systematically are removed from the land into large urban sprawls where they become totally dependent on money. They're no longer dependent on each other. They're dependent on anonymous institutions. And what I ended up seeing in Ladakh is that this system, you know, not only destroys self-esteem and self-respect and identity, but by destroying livelihoods, it creates violence. I mean, when you rob men of self-respect and identity, and then you rob them of the ability to provide for themselves and their families, you created a recipe for violence. And I have been for almost 40 years, more than 40 years actually, trying to raise awareness about this system and about the urgent need to decentralize economic power.
So how long did it take for that culture to be destroyed in your, you know, I mean, when was it you went back and saw that it was?
Well, I ended up, because I was so fascinated and fell in love with the place, I gave up. I was living in Paris before I went out there, and I gave up my job in Paris, and I was going to do a PhD on the language. And in recording and writing down, this it was an ancient form of Tibetan, and getting to know the whole region. It's a big region about the size of Austria, with about 100 villages and, you know, smaller towns spread throughout the desert. I ended up basically staying there. I mean, I didn't go back to the West for 2 years. I didn't stay in Ladakh itself the whole time because it was politically very sensitive. I was accused of being a CIA agent. And but anyway, over the years, I have ended up now for 40 years involved there and going back almost every year.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I thought it was interesting you said that when they saw movies of Americans who looked to be so rich and looked to be like they weren't, didn't really have to work for all that, that they considered themselves poor. I mean, I read that about Soviet Russia as well, that it was the Beatles that in part brought down the Soviet Union because young people saw all these movies and got the impression that things were so much better in the West, and of course they're not. That's just Hollywood.
Yeah. Exactly. No, that became very clear. And again, you know, I hadn't, within my own life, I had never realized how incredibly powerful these images are and what a big role they play. The advertising, the films, basically romanticize an urban consumer culture, and it really does completely distort the reality, and it's sold and packaged in many different ways, even in the school books. And yeah, I mean, young people ended up with the impression that their parents, who were asking them to work, were just, you know, ridiculous, because if they could just make their way to this American dream world, then they wouldn't need to work. It's just a question of pushing a few buttons and then having infinite amounts of wealth, and yeah, very, very distorted impressions.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I thought was really interesting was that, talking about localization versus globalization, that farmers actually can make a lot more money when they go local and like sell their products in the farmer's market, where they get 100% of returns, whereas they only get about 10% of returns when they put it on the global market, which is incredibly inefficient. I mean, it is amazing that the global market trumps over the local markets.
Well, again, I think what I've seen from, you know, seeing so clearly in Ladakh, that when you have a more localized economy, it is so much more efficient. And seeing how with economic development, suddenly in came butter from the other side of the Himalayas, literally having been transported for a week, and it would sell for half the price of local butter. That set me on a journey, and I ended up studying this around the world, and I found that it was true everywhere I went, from Kenya to Australia to Mongolia to Europe, that products from thousands of miles away would cost less than products from a mile away. And especially the butter story, I mean, it was amazing. You know, in Mongolia, they literally had 20 million milk-producing animals, and you could never in the countryside of Mongolia run out of butter or cream. But in Ulaanbaatar, in the city where everyone was being pulled in, the butter came from Germany. And in England, in Devon, famous for its rich milk and butter, butter from New Zealand costs a third of the price of local butter.
And why would that be?
Well, this is what's really, for me, motivates me so much, is that most economists who promote what they think is free trade, what they think is a fair playing field, and who believe in a type of liberal economy where governments are not interfering, because they really believe that the market will level things and be the best way of sorting things out, because they've seen that heavy bureaucracy and top-down structures don't work very well. They don't realize that the system we have is full of hidden subsidies for giant monopolies, for global monopolies. So just like global banks are deregulated and allowed to rob the rest of society, whereas small credit unions or financial institutions are overregulated, in the same way, across the board, giant monopolies are given not just the freedom to do as they like, but they are supported by the money that's extracted from local businesses and banks and individuals that are taxed and squeezed for taxes, and then those taxes turn around subsidizing monopolies that don't pay tax. That's basically the system we have. And I think that the reason it's been allowed to operate is really because most people don't understand it. So what I see is that a lot of the grassroots activists who are despairing of the injustice, you know, the widening gap between rich and poor, despairing of the waste, and the, you know, they hear about the subsidies to the fossil fuel industry and so on, they still don't have the big picture, and so they're not even aware of this mad and, you know, crazy system, and they often end up on the wrong side of that system. So the blindness really is what I see as the problem, the blindness from the grassroots to the top. And I say the top, I mean that the highest level of government and industry, multinationals, people can happily talk about increasing jobs and increasing prosperity while actually destroying the livelihoods for the you know, majority of people. They're able to get away with talking about efficiency when in fact what they're doing couldn't be more inefficient. You know, they're getting away with talking about how they don't want to see subsidies and regulations, but not realizing how unfair the system is. So I think for me, you know, that gives me hope. It gives me hope that if we can get the bigger picture out, that there could be a sort of aha. Where above all left and right categories are abandoned, because right now there's a tragic way that the left and right are getting more and more polarized.
I think they're, you know, being intentionally polarized, so that,
oh yeah,
we'll be shooting at each other instead of shooting at the real culprits, who would be
absolutely
big corporations. Yeah.
No, I mean, I say blindness, and yet I also am very aware that in the system are huge amounts of money to destroy competitors, to destroy opposition. It's quite remarkable how the system operates, because I think there's... without a doubt, there are quite conscious attempts to polarize and divide us across every possible dividing line, and all the time, you know, preventing us from just stepping back and seeing the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. So if you had local farmers grow, I mean, it's not that they're less efficient. I mean, it's not like there's economies of scale that make...
No, this is really important that we really understand that when it comes to every basic need, food, clothing, shelter, and the living earth, which is the real economy we all depend on, efficiencies of scale are a myth, an absolute myth. I mean, it's almost to the point where the smaller the bit of land you would look after, the more efficient you can be. And the key about all of that is that we need more eyes, more human eyes per acre, because what's developed is a system where farmers have been systematically pushed off the land and replaced by machinery, big, blind, stupid machinery using lots of energy. And it means that, you know, every apple gets picked, even if only half are really ripe enough. And then you have machinery that washes and you know, packages and puts it on the supermarket shelf, and we have tons of food burned or thrown away because it doesn't fit the machinery. And all of that system also cannot deal with diversity. You can't have a farmer talking to a large supermarket chain saying, well, you know, today my basil is actually, you know, ripe enough and I can deliver, you know, X amount. But tomorrow there won't be any, but I will have some leeks, or, you know, I will have some milk or some eggs. No, the whole system has been created in the essentially because it's been created by men who are trying to extract as much wealth and power as possible from the majority. So from the very beginning, it's been a push for a type of industrial production, which in terms of making the few rich and extracting from the many, it works. But in terms of efficiently using the natural world to produce what we need, it could not be more wasteful. It could not be more criminally toxic, polluting, and wasteful. And the biggest waste of all is that we're throwing people on the dump. You know, it's jobless growth. Systematically, we're replacing people with energy and technology. And when you contrast any two bits of land anywhere in this world, you will never be able to produce as much out of a piece of land if you only use monoculture. You know, whether it's just having some trees as well as some vegetables, and ideally you would have McDonald's farm. You know, you would have lots of different animals, you would have grain, you would have fruit and vegetables. And that diversity means that everything is part of a cycle. I mean, the animals in those diverse farms never compete with human consumption. They're eating waste, and then they produce fertilizer and high quality protein, you know, for the farm and for the human population. So there is no doubt that particularly the animal monocultures are absolutely the most wasteful, toxic way of producing. But, you know, when you have giant fields of soybeans, or when you've got eucalyptus forests, which are basically destroying Portugal. I mean, Portugal has been covered with eucalyptus monocultures, and they're all burning now and just destroying that country. It's really tragic, because there are, in this whole system, I see a lot of well-intentioned people who simply, you know, have fallen for the idea that there is such a thing as efficiency of scale, and we must have larger and larger farms to feed the global population. There are too many of us now to actually go local. And it's completely the opposite of the truth.
And then the question is, how do you go local today? I mean, for instance, you've got all these people in the inner city that don't have any land, but they don't have any money to buy any land either. So, I mean, I've heard it's really hard to be a farmer in the U.S. today.
Well, it's very hard to be a farmer anywhere in the world today, because farmers have been systematically marginalized now for hundreds of years. So, you know, the farmers we have in Africa and India, China, you know, they've all been marginalized because of an emphasis on industrialization and urbanization. And that's where Ladakh and Bhutan, where I also worked, were so important to show what's possible if we get out from under this type of enslavement, really, and which, as you know, debt is a fundamental part of it. It's amazing what we could do. And I have to say, what gives me more hope than anything is seeing every single day more examples of new local food initiatives that are demonstrating that even in a world where you have all these hidden subsidies, you've got over-regulation of small farmers and small businesses, you've got, you know, a market where people are being trained to want, you know, perfectly shiny apples without a single spot on them. And, you know, you have an entire system. You have a media which covers up and tries to block everything you do. Despite that, every single day there are new local food initiatives. And they are miraculously managing to demonstrate that when you diversify on the farm, and you can really only do that if you shorten the distance between the farm and the table. And shortening the distance doesn't mean, you know, to 1 mile away or even 10 miles away. It means moving out from the grip of a global monopoly economy where literally things from Argentina cost less than things from next door. So even, you know, as we localize, we're talking about a systemic shift in direction. We're not talking about some kind of absolute. But when cities, and this is happening, from big cities, start reconnecting with the land, sometimes the land in the city, sometimes the land right around the city, sometimes the city relating to the region, you are getting a very different form of agriculture, and you're getting a dialogue between the consumers and the producers that is really bearing fruit, you know, in every, both literally and metaphorically.
So what do you recommend to people? What would city dwellers here do?
No, the first thing is that first is to realize to, I hope they go to our website, localfutures.org, and they'll see lots of examples of these things happening. And they'll see that what we encourage is that you, first of all, change the I to a we. Don't go at this alone. Try to just identify a few like-minded individuals and start thinking about what can we do, rather than what can I do as an isolated individual consumer. Probably once you get the bigger picture and you start looking at the local food movement, you'll find that in your area of your city, there'll be something happening that will be worthy of your support. And it's not just going and buying at the farmer's market. We're talking about trying to build a movement that keeps growing this shift, which is a shift away from dependence on monopolistic corporations to depending on one another, on more human scale businesses. And by the way, you know, in the local food movement, it's not about cutting out the middleman. Some of the best examples are where you have farmers linked to a local shop in the city. The farmers may be outside the city in the region, linked to a shop in the city, and consumers in the city who realize how important it is for reducing plastic, reducing CO2 emissions, getting healthier for themselves and creating a healthier environment, and supporting an economy that will provide for jobs and that will make people able to prosper and survive in the region, and how important that is for reducing violence and conflict. So anyway, so all of this comes together in lots of different projects. Some of the initiatives, I've just learned of one the other day. We had a conference in Vermont this past weekend, and I learned that there anyway, you can set up an investment club. If you have less than 200 people and less than $2 million, you can basically do as you like. You don't have to worry about regulations. And so they're setting up, that's one model of, you know, you set up an investment club in this particular area of Vermont. There were 25 people who got together. They've been able to raise $250,000. And with that, they're starting to invest in their own local economy and starting to build a healthier direction. So there are things that we can do from the grassroots right now. There are other things that are part of the localization movement, which is about supporting local independent businesses that are both more accountable, more visible, overall employ more people than the giant corporations, and they are environmentally more sustainable. Of course, not every local business is, but we're looking at a movement that cares both about climate and about people. It's not just one or the other. There's a systemic shift towards local where you can improve both the environment and the social fabric.
Yeah, I think just raising awareness is very important. When people realize that they really don't want to eat GMO foods and they don't want all those toxic chemicals, and that local food is healthier for them, and that the economy would be better off for it. So what you're doing is very helpful in that way. You're raising consciousness.
Oh, I'm so glad you say so, because I actually feel this is one of the big problems in the localization movement, is that there are quite a lot of people who tend to believe we know it all, we don't need any more talking, let's just get on with the action, let's just build the examples. And I've been trying to say for a long time, no, we need educationist activism. It's what I call big picture activism. was we really need to get that bigger picture and emphasize consciousness raising, like you said. And so, yeah, there are more and more models of people doing just that. And it's working because it is so much more efficient. So even though there are all these hidden subsidies for the big and the global, and those subsidies, they include research at university, they include, a whole range of ways that our taxes are spent to work against us, to actually encourage fossil fuel use, pollution, plastic, triple layers of packaging, long distance transport. And despite all that, because of the absolute efficiency of doing things on a smaller scale and more diversified, there are many inspiring examples.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're also about going local, but in a different way. Public banking is where the people would own the banks, and the banks go, the profits go back to the people, back to the economy. Of course, they go to the government, but this is the local government that then spends them into the economy. So it can be a self-sustaining system without continual growth, which is the big problem with, financialization and sucking interest and profits off the top. So I suppose you probably think more in terms of community currencies.
No, I don't. I'm not a fan of community currencies. We helped to start some about 20 years ago from our office in Berkeley and also in Vermont, and they ran for about 10 years. But I would say to anybody who's interested in localization to please look first, to really see what is succeeding and what isn't. And there are very good reasons why the local food movement is so hugely successful, whereas, I'm sorry to say, local currencies are really not successful at all. And, now we have, about, in our case, in my organization, we've been promoting this, studying it, working with it around the world for more than 30 years. So we have a wealth of experience. And it simply is the case that they're not working. So I would urge everyone to rethink if they think that that's the best way to get things going. It turns out that they tend to the extent that they've been started around the world, they've tended to answer to marginal needs, in other words, massage, babysitting, that kind of thing. Right. And whereas paying for food, paying for rent, and so on, it wasn't possible to persuade people who are caught in a system that's dependent on the national currency to shift. So it's really fascinating for me to see that we can start this whole trend by using the national currency, but by creating relationships between producers and consumers, which creates structures that would be very easily shifted to a more regional or local currency if we succeed in doing that. But I really urge people to start by working with the national currency and then doing things like the investment club, or setting up a local revolving fund to help get things going. I would also definitely urge them to simultaneously do the consciousness raising that we need to do to shift the dominant system, not just the banking system, but the global monopolies that are continuing to manipulate our politics, that are driving up unemployment, driving up pollution, and really, that globalized economy is the main cause of almost all the crises we face. So we need to be simultaneously as we start some of these local initiatives, also raising consciousness to build up a movement for political change.
I totally agree. Just on the economics of happiness, so how would you define, or what have you seen in terms of like actual happiness, and what would you call, Who are the happiest people? I mean, of course, they're the ones living off the land, but what factors make them happy?
Well, thanks for asking these questions. Yeah, for sure what we're seeing is that people who feel more connected to other people and who feel more connected to nature, to the plants, to the animals, to their place, are generally happier, more confident, and kinder and more tolerant people. We've seen wonderful examples of, for instance, prisoners who have been, you know, their whole lives they've only known anger and frustration, and sometimes within weeks of being helped to produce food, to garden, and to do it in community, they can change. We've seen delinquent youth, you know, being taken out into nature and essentially guided to create more of a community relationship, not trying to appear perfect and tough and I don't need anybody sort of thing, but actually learning to soften their hearts and to be willing to talk about what causes them pain, what their problems are, and learning some, you know, basic skills in nature. You know, some of these projects might take them out camping, and, you know, just learning how to make a fire and how to cook together is something that many people have never done. And, you know, there are other stories that, you know, when you really look at it from our perspective, the evidence is just enormous. You know, it includes things like studies that show if you in hospital have a window that looks out on a tree or the sky, your healing is faster than if you're just, you know, in a windowless room. You have all these projects where animals are brought into old people's homes or hospitals. And again, it's just amazing how it increases both health and happiness. We know more and more about the link between depression and loss of self-esteem, which has to do with feeling isolated and alone and as though you don't have anyone who cares about you.
I used to live in Kenya and Guatemala and Nicaragua and Honduras when my ex-husband worked for USAID. And I observed the same thing where the people did seem happier, though, although they had nothing, but they had this sort of inherent happiness. And these are people that technically you would say lived on $2 a day. I mean, that's what you hear about people that live on under $2 a day and they're desperately poor. Of course, if they're so poor that they are sick, you know, they don't have food or whatever, then of course they are desperately poor. But typically these are people that have a little plot of land. They have chicken, you know, a chicken maybe, and they grow some greens and they trade with each other. So the $2 is really only for things that they can't make in their own, you know, little community. And because they don't really have any, they can't really strive to be the president of a corporation or, you know, all the things that we push our kids to be. They really have nowhere to go but to have their holidays. And, you know, that's what they look forward to next is their next social occasion. And they don't really worry too much about fashion. If they have, it doesn't matter if the socks match. If they keep their feet dry, then that's the purpose of a pair of socks. So it does seem to me that we just have a sort of skewed set of values. And if we got back to what's really, you know, important about people is not what they own or what they wear or, you know, those flashy things, but relationships.
Yeah, and I see, again, I think it's so much about raising awareness, because I think there are so many parents who are pushing their children to succeed because they still believe that that's what's needed to make them happy. And we really just need more psychological literacy, or if you like, emotional intelligence. We need more ecological literacy. And I use the term eco-literacy for both ecological and economic literacy. The economic system as a system you know, which really did start with slavery and colonialism, and that means by force, you know, created a situation that was ideal for these global traders. You know, you have slaves on one side of the world, and then on the other side you have people who've also been enslaved. You know, the enclosures in Europe pushed people off the land to become cheap labor in the big factories. And so they had these giant trading, globally active businesses that ended up dominating, and they've just continued unabated since that time. It's really helpful once you see how absolutely central scale is in all of this. How when you have these large anonymous structures, they're not accountable, we don't even, you know, get our heads around them. I think that's the biggest problem. I think we have this tragic division now between left and right, where we're holding on to old categories that are simply not relevant. Of course, if we were to get back to more human and accountable scale, there might be, well, I think there would be very significant differences between people's values. But I think that ending this stranglehold by monopolies, coming back to some genuine democratic process whereby we would determine the shape of business rather than having business shaping society, I think that's an agenda we could come, you know, that we could all agree on as a way of shifting the political scene that's going on today.
Well, that's what we do in the Public Banking Institute. We have people from both sides or all sides or whatever. But I try to just always focus on the things we have in common and just ignore those things that we disagree on. And it seems to work. I mean, even like money reformers, when I first started getting into this field, there were other money reformers that were always like arguing about those things. But I've found that it's better not to argue. It's better to just go on with your thing and look for the commonalities, and you make a lot more progress.
I totally agree.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time, but really great talking to you. And I wondered if you'd like to give your website and tell people what they can do and where they can find you and all that.
Yeah, our website is localfutures.org. And we have, you know, this film called The Economics of Happiness that is being used now in communities around the world to raise awareness about the urgent need to get clarity on the need for systemic shift, and particularly transforming this global economy into something that is democratic and accountable, waking people up to the fact that it's not big government per se that's the problem, it's big business working with big government to overregulate and squeeze and tax the small guys. And in doing that, they're creating a situation where many people who are squeezed are ending up fearful and often voting for fascist leaders around the world. So it's a really urgent issue that we understand the economic and identity crisis that's going on for the majority of people. That's just as urgent as climate. I mean, they're completely linked. I mean, this is also what's so encouraging is when you realize that all of these problems that seem like separate issues and seem almost totally overwhelming are linked. So we have films, we have a workshop, we have a series of conferences, we have some books and materials that can be used by local communities. So I hope people will come to our website. They will also find a series called Planet Local, where we highlight some examples from around the world. It's really helpful when you look at this from a global point of view. It helps to, again, break down some of these right-left categories. And that's what we're doing. We're a small organization, but we're working on every continent, essentially raising awareness and catalyzing localization initiatives. I'm very grateful for your work, Ellen. It's a very important part of what we are promoting, and really happy that I could be with you on this program.
Thank you. I'm very grateful for yours, and thanks very much for coming on our show. Good luck to your tours.
Thank you.
Ellen's guest today was Helena Norberg Hodge, the founder of Local Futures. Her work can be found at localfutures.org. And while we're at it, let me remind you that you can find Ellen's latest articles posted on her blog and website at ellenbrown.com. Every now and again, we like to let you glide around with a little public banking jingle adapted from The Wizard of Oz by one of our public bank supporters, Steve Behrman in California, who produced this mindful little ditty in support of creating a California public bank. Now, while Steve did this recording a couple years ago, you should know that the topic of public banks in California has now gotten real momentum. From Los Angeles, which is considering a city-owned bank, to Oakland and San Francisco, which are also taking action in that direction, all the way up to the state treasurer's office and the two leading candidates for governor in the state who've expressed serious interest. So, who knows? Maybe California will finally get on board and make it happen.
California, the failure because we haven't got a bank.
Well, what would you do with a bank if you had one?
Do? If California had a bank?
We could rightly use what's ours to cultivate the flowers and clean our septic tank. We could trade unemployment for service and enjoyment if we only had a bank. When we're stuck and need some credit and Wall Street says forget it, we won't be in the tank. We could pass on lesser offers, borrow cash from our own coffers if we only had a bank. Oh, why? Tell me why? The economy hit the floor. We're sinking lower than we sunk before. And all the jobs, they've gone offshore. We can stimulate production, construction, and instruction by standing for this plank. Just 11 million voters will be like North Dakota, we'll finally have a bank. If we get up off our assets and get the folks to pass it, we'll finally have a bank. A bank.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.